From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk to one of the most highly respected writers to come out of the San Joaquin Valley, Gerald Haslam. A historian, novelist, essayist, and biographer, his latest book tells the amazing and touching story of Taft athlete Leon Patterson, and in the process gives us new insights into life in Kern County in the 1950s. We'll also follow up last week's conversation with the journalist who is seeking to kayak the San Joaquin from Fresno to San Francisco with someone who completed an even more amazing feat some three decades ago, a kayak journey from downtown Bakersfield all the way to the shores of San Francisco Bay. But first, supporters of California's high-speed rail project have long touted the bullet train's ability to create jobs and transform the valley's economy since the issue went before voters nearly 6 years ago. And while construction on the line itself has yet to begin, FM89's Ezra David Romero reports that for some Fresno area workers, those jobs are starting to become real.
Daniel Reese moved with his family from Seattle to Fresno to take care of his parents about a year ago, but found it really hard to find a job.
I was pretty much on the verge of going homeless. I'm a family man, three children.
He looked up and down the valley for any decent paying job, but found none.
Started doubting myself, like, wow, what did I do? The jobs that we're hiring were very part-time at very low pay rate. I didn't know where I was going to go from week to week.
But thanks to one of the first construction jobs in advance of the much-disputed initial stretch of California high-speed rail, Reese's luck turned around. In early June, he was hired as a supervisor on a hazardous waste abatement team through Catch Environmental in Fresno. Their task? The 24 men spend their days clearing out unsafe material, like lead and asbestos, from sites that will soon meet the wrecking ball. At Catch Environmental's warehouse, just north of the Fresno airport, Paul Cacciadorian's team gathers the equipment they need for the day. Gas masks, brooms, shovels, and air purifiers. It's not a glorious job, but it's one of the first visible signs of work on California's controversial high-speed rail project. But for these men, it's more than a project milestone. It's a job and a chance for a fresh start. Reese didn't have any experience working in construction, but when he heard about this job, he jumped at the opportunity.
I'm a chef by trade. I cooked for 20 years. Coming into this environment was just an opener, you know. I knew it was going to be hard work, but I'm used to hard work. I have no knowledge at all as far as asbestos, lead, or anything like that.
Reese's story isn't unique. A lot of these men have been without work for months on end. But some of them have a past, felonies and even jail time. And that's why Cacciadorian hired them.
I want to have an opportunity to lift people up and to give them well-paying jobs that are full-time and long-term.
Cacciadorian and the high-speed rail team gave Reese and the others ample training in lead and asbestos removal, as well as in safety and environmental hazards. Elizabeth Jonathan is a spokeswoman for the state's future bullet train.
Catch has really gone out of its way to hire these men that would probably not have been given other chances. He has seen talent in men, prepared them, everything from basic training to managerial level training, so that they can take this with them for the rest of their lives.
So what does this mean for high-speed rail? Jonathan says that while we aren't seeing bridges and tracks yet on the future rail line, people are getting jobs. She says that's important because the valley has
historic low unemployment, has low educational levels, and when there's companies like this willing to step up and invest in our people and give them meaningful employment, that's what it's all about.
And it's this investment in training that Reese says has changed his life.
Oh, I feel this is my future. I feel like I could actually retire from this project. I'll make enough to take care of my family and my mom and dad, and maybe give back a little bit to the community as well.
This work is just the beginning of construction of the rail line, and as Jonathan says, more opportunities are bound to come for men in a tough spot like Reese. Reporting from downtown Fresno, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. As the California drought meets the summer heat, water managers continue to look for ways to secure water for people who need it. Governor Jerry Brown wants more recycled water production throughout California. The administration has made more than $800 million available in loan financing for water agencies to treat wastewater. Pauline Bartolone has more now on how farmers in Fresno County are already using what otherwise might go to waste.
Jim Quist farms 700 acres next to one of the most secure water sources in Fresno County.
Might be Providence, whatever brought my grandfather here in 1933.
That water source is treated sewage. Lindquist Farm is just across the road from the city of Fresno's wastewater treatment plant. It's been giving him water for 50 years.
There's been times that we didn't like being here just because of the smell, but those things have gotten better, fortunately.
Quist says the water quality has become more employee-friendly over the years, too. Public health codes prevent him from using it on food crops, but Quist says it's a big help for his alfalfa fields. The drought has forced cutbacks on his surface water allotment, and the groundwater level is sinking. This reclaimed wastewater is free and always available.
It can make a huge difference having access to this water compared to pumping it out of the ground. It's a big help.
60 million gallons of wastewater are pulled from sewer pipes and into the Fresno Municipal Wastewater Treatment Plant every day.
These are some of the largest pumps that you will ever see.
Chief of Operations Rick Staggs gives a tour of the plant. The first line of treatment is filtering out the garbage that comes through sewer lines from restaurants, households, and industries.
2x4s, plastics, rags.
The water is then piped into big pools.
What that does is that allows those things that are going to float to the top and those things that are going to settle to the bottom.
Then there's a biological process that further breaks down organic compounds and contaminants.
These are the aeration basins. Basically what we're doing is we're growing microorganisms that treat the waste.
The fluid getting the final treatment looks like river water flowing through a flat fountain bed.
We're basically taking what nature does and we're doing it at a much higher and faster level.
Conrad Braganza is also with Fresno Wastewater Management. He says recycling water allows potable water to be saved for drinking and lower quality water to be used for irrigation.
There's no new water being added in the planet, so it really comes down to how effectively we manage our current resources.
But right now, the wastewater Fresno treats has very limited application. It's only used by farmers for non-food crops and to fill ponds to recharge underground aquifers. The plant managers plan to treat to a higher level and disinfect the water so it can be used to irrigate schoolyards, golf courses, and cemeteries. Farmers would be able to water food crops with it too. Braganza again.
Once we treat to this higher level, it increases, one, the number of uses for the water. It cuts down the city's dependence on clean water for non-potable uses. And it basically makes us a sustainable city because we're not depleting our groundwater aquifer as much.
California state water managers call it a new water resource. They say they're in the process of loaning out hundreds of millions of dollars to water agencies like Fresno. Lester Snow of the California Water Foundation wants more investment in recycled water. He says it's reliable, unlike the climate.
We're getting more of our winter precipitation as rain instead of snowpack, so that kind of changes water supply availability. But also we're seeing a much greater variability in the amount that we get.
But Snow says recycled water is only one part of securing California's water future.
We can do more through conservation, wastewater recycling, stormwater capture, managing our groundwater better. So there's a lot of pieces, but it's a significant piece of the solution.
The Fresno plant has applied for a state loan to expand recycled water production. California wants all funded projects to be up and running within 3 years. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
We'll continue our series on recycled water next week as FM89's Carrie Klein reports on how the city of Clovis is already breaking new ground in that area. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week on our program, we talked with John D. Sutter, the CNN journalist who is on a mission to kayak the San Joaquin River from Fresno to San Francisco Bay as part of a reporting project on what has been called America's most endangered river. He's currently just outside of Stockton, making his way to San Francisco, hopefully by July 4th. We had a lot of comments on that segment, including one from listener Sean Boyd, who reminded us of a similar but more lengthy trip back in 1983. That year, which was exceptionally wet, Bill Cooper and John Sweetser made what is thought to be the first ever kayak trip from downtown Bakersfield to San Francisco Bay. Bill Cooper joins us now on Valley Edition. He is today the president of the Kern River Parkway Foundation. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
Take us back to that year, 1983, and this adventure that began that spring. How exactly did you and John come up with the idea to take on such a mammoth undertaking?
Well, growing up in the south part of the valley, you always hear these stories about the early years when people could actually sail boats from Bakersfield to San Francisco. It kind of became a truism, you know, and there had been people who had taken boats in the early 1930s. Frank Lotta, the former head of the Kern County Museum, did it with his son in a powerboat, and then in 1966 was a good year, and I think Ken Waddell, who has since passed away, a farmer in Kern County, did it with his son, I think, and also in a powerboat. So, you know, you grow up with that, and then all of a sudden, this weather change came, and one cold, wet storm after another rolled in, and it just kind of took off. And a mutual friend put me in contact with John, who had been talking about giving it a shot. I'd never been in a kayak in my life before, and so we scouted up to Tulare Lake by car, because that was the big issue, getting across Tulare Lake. Once you get into the Kings River, San Joaquin River drainage, you're guaranteed of a free ride to San Francisco Bay. So,
tell me a little more about that challenge there, because the Kern River doesn't normally flow straight out to the San Joaquin to San Francisco Bay. This was an exceptional year, but some things had to happen there.
Yeah, it was a very exceptional year. I can't quote the exact statistics on snowpack and the runoff, but it was. And when the old Kern Lake bed and Buena Vista Lake bed fill up, and there's a lot of extra water, they go through the Goose Lake Slough north. There is a natural geological formation that prevents the water from going into Tulare Lake naturally. I mean, not naturally, but in most years. But that year, it filled up and spilled over and reforming much of the lake. So we determined that, well, you know, we can make it in kayaks. So we went back and threw a sleeping bag in our kayaks and a couple of little tents and took off.
Did you have any idea of what you were getting into? This story eventually made national news. Did you realize, was this something that you were trying to gain publicity, or was it just, hey, we're just going to do this and have some fun?
No, I didn't realize. I just wanted to get to Tulare Lake and cross it. And when we got up by Stratford and pulled out for the night, I called my home and talked to my dad. And I said, boy, I'm tired. And it was a couple of days getting there. And I said, I'm ready to come home. And he said, guy, you can't come home now. Everybody's saying you're going all the way. And it's on the news and even a Los Angeles station printed it. And then later on, as we continued the trip, decided to go ahead and try for it. I was on vacation at the time, and we were being interviewed by San Francisco radio stations and the like, and followed by an airplane who was reporting back and that sort of thing. So it kind of grew as we went. We would run into fishermen who would say, hey, are you those crazy guys from Bakersfield? We'd say, yeah, that's us.
Again, if you just joined us today on Valley Edition, we're talking with Bill Cooper. In 1983, he and a friend John Sweetser made what is still a legendary trip, a kayak adventure from downtown Bakersfield all the way to the shores of San Francisco Bay. Of course, that was a very wet year, quite unlike the year we're having. We're talking to him today, as last week on our program, we talked to journalist John D. Sutter, who's making a similar but shorter trek on the San Joaquin, and in many cases where the river is dry, having to drag his canoe along to make the trip. I want to turn back to your adventure back over 30 years ago now. Were you prepared for this type of adventure? Did you have provisions and water and food? You talked about going all the way to San Francisco Bay. Was that something you were ready to do at first?
Not really. We had some basic foods, you know, canned tuna, that sort of thing, and water. And we set our sights way too high. I mean, we thought we'd be to the south end of Tulare Lake in a day. Well, water spreads out and moves very slowly, and we barely made it outside of Button Willow the first day, and then continued into the swamps there south of Tulare Lake. And I think it was Ken Waddell landed his plane on a levee, and we went over, and he actually took us up, and we scouted our way through the through the shallow swampy area, which really helped. And then he asked us if we needed anything, and it was very hot. And I said, "Well, we're down to drinking swamp water, you know." And he went back to wherever he flew out of in Kern County and got some water jugs and duct taped them up, and then flew over us and dropped them into the water, and that was a lifesaver. So we knew we had to really skimp and watch what we used. And once we got into the Kings River area, you know, farms and houses were readily available. We could walk down the road and get water and that sort of thing. So buying food, we stopped in Fireball, places like that, walked down a mile or so to a grocery store and stocked up and kept going.
Tell me about Tulare Lake itself, seeing it reemerge in that very wet of wet years. What was that like? Describe it for us, because so much of that land has been turned into farmland, and in most years it's dry. But in this year, it was quite the opposite.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact size of it, but at one point it was the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi, although not very deep. It was area-wise, it was huge. And even in that year, it didn't form to all of its natural historical area. But it was fairly deep that year. It took us really all day long to cross it on the western levee. We stayed close to levees, and it was a job getting across it. There was a little bit of a wind, and it was quite choppy, and I don't know what kind of fish they were, but they kept kind of jumping up and hitting the boat. I never was sure what they were. And then we entered from the north side. We entered the an overflow coming out of the Kings River that was dumping directly into Tulare Lake. So we went against the current upstream for, seemed like 20 miles, to get into the main channel of the Kings River. And so you have to understand that the Kern River was flowing in, but also the Kings River and probably White River and Deer Creek and those Pozo Creek, those kinds of smaller streams were also feeding into it, which historically they always did. It's a huge area, but you know, I'm really not certain how big it got that year.
Has anyone, to your knowledge, ever successfully completed a similar trek since?
I haven't heard of anybody. It doesn't mean, at least locally. I heard about some guys out of Reedley one year that tried to take some canoes, and once you get down the San Joaquin River into the Fresno Slough, big broad area down there, the wind really beats you. You're getting the wind right in your face, and in kayaks you can skim along. It's work, but you can. But in canoes, where you're sitting upright, I heard these fellows had a real tough time. So I haven't, and the water hasn't been there. The old story that you can, that boats actually sail from Bakersfield north is ridiculous. Now there was a flat bottom steamboat on Tulare Lake, which serviced, I guess, farms back in the 1800s. But that would be about the extent of it. South of there, there was no way that a boat could navigate. We used man-made canals that were maintained and stuff. You know, those didn't exist back in those days. In fact, San Francisco, one of the newspapers in the late 1800s, sent a reporter down the west side of the valley to report on the possibility that area could be settled and farmed and the like. And the reporter wrote that you could see these lakes, these bodies of water, but you could die of thirst trying to fight your way through the tules and the rushes getting to the water. So there was just no navigable way for any kind of a sizable boat. Of course, Native Americans had boats, but they weren't designed for long treks. You know.
Do you often reflect back on that adventure now, some 30 years later?
Only when I'm reminded of it, like this fella, and when my shoulder starts to hurt. I injured it on the trip, and I have arthritis in it. But other than that, I don't think about it too much. I guess if we another year rolled in next year, I wouldn't undertake it again. It was 12 solid days of work, I mean, sun up to sundown. And when we got to Richmond Marina in San Francisco Bay, rather than cross over to San Francisco, we hung it up right there. You know, we were tired. It was an amazing trip. I learned a lot about the geography of the valley and have seen the mistakes that we're still making up around Stockton. I mean, there are houses built since my trip that are in areas that were underwater. And you see that and you think, what are they thinking? You know, you don't have to go back very far to realize that there was 3 or 4 or 5 feet of water on that very ground, and now there are whole housing tracts there. So
it's a fascinating story indeed, and certainly in this dry year, it's hard to imagine, but that's sort of the story of the valley. Not enough water in the dry years, and sometimes too much when it all comes at one time. Our guest today has been Bill Cooper. He is today the president of the Kern River Parkway Foundation in Bakersfield, but in 1983, he and friend John Sweetser made what is thought to be the first ever kayak trip from downtown Bakersfield to San Francisco Bay. It made national headlines at the time. Bill Cooper, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Valley Edition and find out why yesterday marked a major milestone in the effort to restore Yosemite's Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias. It's all part of the park's 150th anniversary. We'll talk to the president of the Yosemite Conservancy, Mike Tollefson, in just a moment, right after this.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour together each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting. And we can share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. Join us for Travel with Rick Steves, Saturday mornings at 9 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Sometimes living in Central California, we can take the wonders of nature that exist in our own backyard for granted. Of course, while many of us here in the Central Valley would like to claim Yosemite, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon as our very own, in truth they belong to everyone, the crown jewels of the national park system. Yesterday, Yosemite, and the park system itself, for that matter, celebrated a major milestone, the 150th anniversary of the original proclamation by Abraham Lincoln that established Yosemite as a park. Joining us now on Valley Edition is Mike Tollefson. He is the president of the Yosemite Conservancy. Mike, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The ceremony on Monday was very special, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Yosemite grant. You had dignitaries and folks from your organization, the park, and elected representatives there. Tell us about the scene celebrating Yosemite's sesquicentennial.
Well, it was very exciting, and as it should be, it was in Mariposa Grove with a couple of giant sequoias in the background, and it was a great honor to be there and celebrate the special day when President Lincoln set aside Mariposa Grove and Yosemite Valley during the Civil War 150 years ago.
Why Mariposa Grove is the setting for that ceremony?
Mariposa Grove was actually there were ceremonies both in Mariposa Grove and in Yosemite Valley, but the Mariposa Grove ceremony was there for two reasons. One, it signifies the area that President Lincoln set aside for all people for all time, but also it's where the National Park Service and we, the Yosemite Conservancy, are partnering with them to do the restoration of the Mariposa Grove, starting with a groundbreaking at the ceremony.
So tell me a little more about this ceremony and the announcement that your group, the Yosemite Conservancy, made. You're a private, a nonprofit foundation that works very closely with the National Park Service to help preserve and restore the beauty of Yosemite. You announced, as what I understand, is a $20 million donation on Monday.
We did. The Mariposa Grove campaign, the total project's a $30 million project, and National Park Service is contributing 16 of that, and we're honored that our supporters all across the state and the country are contributing the other $20 million to make a restoration of Mariposa Grove that absolutely important project it should be for the giant sequoia.
So what sort of changes will we be seeing at Mariposa Grove in the future for folks who are familiar with that area?
Listeners that have driven into the Grove know you arrive in and amongst the trees in the parking lot, and it's not a very grand entrance into such a grand grove. And secondly, the sequoia trees, their root system spreads out about 200 feet from the big trees, and it's just below the surface of the ground. And they have a parking lot and cars and all kinds of vehicles on top of it, plus on hot days like it was yesterday, to have the sun beating down on the asphalt transferring to the roots is not long-term sustainable for the trees. So the project will remove the parking lot, and the parking lot will be just outside the grove. And then you'll arrive by shuttle into the grove, and you'll arrive to a new fully accessible trail. In the place of where the trams are today, there'll be a boardwalk through a beautiful meadow instead of asphalt that most of the public can't even walk on. So it's the lower part of the grove is going to see a fabulous transition. It's not only makes the grove more sustainable for the future, but also as the visitor experience.
A lot of minds were turned back to the original proclamation in 1864 by President Lincoln as he set up aside area of Yosemite Valley and the land, embracing, as he said, the Mariposa Big Tree Grove to preserve it for public use, resort, and recreation. What do you think President Lincoln would say if he could look back and now see the park today?
You know, I think going beyond the park even, I don't know that he had a full understanding of what was going to grow from the seed of his idea. You know, to a national park system of over 400 parks, to great state park systems like California, to international parks in China, in Chile, all over the world, in Mongolia, those three parks are actually in Yosemite for this 150th celebration.
It's very exciting indeed, and a milestone not only for Yosemite itself, but as you said, for the state park system, which also bears its genesis in this proclamation from President Lincoln in 1864 and the national park system itself. We've been talking with Mike Tollefson. He is the president of the Yosemite Conservancy on the 150th anniversary of the Yosemite grant by President Lincoln, which eventually established what we know today as Yosemite National Park. The Conservancy announced on Monday a $20 million private contribution to aid in the restoration and preservation of the Mariposa Grove. Mr. Tollefson, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. And your listeners can see that work on our site, yosemiteconservancy.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much today for taking the time.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. If you were paying attention to the news a few weeks ago, you may have heard a story about this new database the state of California released that ranks every neighborhood in the state in terms of its overall pollution burden. It looked not only at things like air pollution, water pollution, but it also looked at economic issues, unemployment, poverty, high school graduation rates. This combination of data on pollution sources mixed with demographic information strikes at the heart of this issue called environmental justice, that there are some communities in the state that are especially burdened by the worst of the worst. In this edition of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State philosophy professor Andrew Fiala takes on the issue of environmental ethics and says it's about time we have a serious conversation about the value of nature, what we value, and why we value it.
Governor Jerry Brown recently said humanity is on a collision course with nature. He was referring to climate change and the early advent of the fire season here in California. In related remarks, Brown said we have to live with nature. But how should we live with nature? We fundamentally disagree about the value of nature and what it means to live with nature. Some people think that nature has value in itself, apart from our interests. Others think that nature exists for us to use and exploit. In addition to this dispute, we also disagree about how we ought to distribute and manage the harms associated with environmental problems. One version of environmental ethics, often called deep ecology, maintains that natural things have intrinsic value. Thus, if a glacier melts or a forest burns, something of inherent value is destroyed. To live with nature from this ecocentric perspective means to respect the dignity and integrity of the natural world. A different version of environmental ethics holds that the value of natural things depends upon their value for us. They are tools with so-called instrumental value. From this anthropocentric perspective, living with nature means that we should find a way to manage and control nature for our benefit. The differences between ecocentric ecologists and anthropocentric environmentalists are not easy to resolve. A further debate concerns the question of how we should distribute the harms caused by our collision with nature. The standpoint of what is called environmental justice asks us to apply ideas about social justice in the environmental context. Disagreements about social justice also run deep. Some think that the poor should be left to fend for themselves. Others think that the rich ought to be taxed and their wealth redistributed to the poor. Should rich people who consume the most fossil fuels, water, land, and other resources be taxed so that the poor might be helped to survive the collision with nature? Or are the rich entitled to use whatever they can afford to use? Rich people will do okay in a hot, dry world. The wealthy can move and adapt. And rich people often have the luxury of enjoying natural beauty of the sort celebrated by deep ecologists. Poor people encounter nature more directly and with less control. The poor will suffer the most from environmental problems such as climate change. I'm glad that Governor Brown is directing our attention to environmental issues. Our society needs to have a serious conversation about the value of nature. We must figure out what we value and why we value it. And we need to decide what sorts of obligations we have to the natural world and to our fellow human beings. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
The commentary series The Moral is a production of Valley Public Radio and the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State. The views expressed on the program don't necessarily represent those of the station or of the Bonner Center. You can find more commentaries on our website. Click The Moral Is at kvpr.org. Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. The fact that much of the San Joaquin Valley suffers from chronic double-digit unemployment is nothing new. It's a problem that's vexed politicians and economic development officials in communities like Fresno and Merced for decades. But a new report from the Brookings Institute out today shows that there's another side to the Valley's workforce woes. It can also be one of the most difficult places in the nation for employers to fill a job vacancy in areas like science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Joining us now to tell us more about the report is its author, Jonathan Rothwell. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
This is an interesting report in that you're looking at the alignment of skilled workers and highly skilled positions that are available. What are you finding specific to our region here in Central California and specifically in Fresno?
Well, after analyzing millions of job vacancies nationally and by metropolitan area, we generally found that STEM jobs are the hardest to fill. And in the Fresno area, these jobs are posted or advertised on company websites for very long periods of time, 53 days on average.
How does that compare with other parts of the country or even other parts of the state? Is that 53 days a lot? Tell me a little more about
that. It is a lot. For the United States as a whole, it's 35 days. But that the 53 days is very similar to some of the more tech-oriented parts of California, like San Jose and San Francisco. So it's interesting because Fresno is, of course, a very different economy than those tech-oriented neighbors. There's much less demand for STEM workers, but there's also much lower supply of STEM workers. And as a result, what you see is that jobs for, say, nurses or lab technicians are advertised for very long periods of time, some jobs for computer workers. And then you also have a large number of job vacancies that are constantly advertised in the area because they're in high turnover positions. So in those cases, it's not a measure of hiring difficulty as it would be in the STEM positions. But for some of those STEM positions, the vacancies do last for quite long periods.
And just to explain for our listeners, you use the word STEM. That is a term that a lot of folks in education and economic development use in talking about jobs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. That's a broad category. Is there any one subset there that you find more of a demand for or more of that unmet demand?
Well, in the Fresno area, and this is true nationally as well, healthcare practitioner jobs are one of the occupations with the fastest growth and the most current number of job openings and very long advertisement duration period. So it's roughly 74 days on average for Fresno, which is substantially longer than the U.S. average. And then also another common STEM vacancy with long advertisement duration periods is those for computer and mathematical science occupations. So those could be computer programmers app developers. In the Fresno area, those are advertised for 71 days, but there are not very many jobs advertised in the Fresno area for those skills, and it's much further down the list of occupations than it is in other communities like San Jose or San Francisco.
Now, here in Central California, we have this paradox that folks in elected office and economic development have been talking about for some time, and that we have many positions, as you say, that are very hard to fill, highly skilled positions, yet we have this huge chronic double-digit unemployment rate that goes back for decades, and talk about aligning the educational system to provide training and those sorts of jobs. Are there any hints in looking at the data in your study at possible solutions? Is there a strategy that is particularly effective in trying to address this issue? One thing that I hear a lot of people talk about is the quality of life issue. Is it just about training, or is there another element in the equation?
Well, I think for communities to attract workers from other parts of the country and to some extent other parts of the world, a place needs to offer certain things that people think are pretty essential, like access to good quality schools for their children, access to good restaurants and things like that. In any case, for people that are already in the metropolitan area of Fresno but are unemployed, training can be a hugely important way to get them ready for these jobs. And in many cases, the jobs being advertised in the Fresno area aren't ones that require huge levels of education. Even in the STEM fields, many of the opportunities can be had with an associate's degree or some kind of post-secondary certification. Even high schools have a very important role to play here, and high schools in other parts of the country allow their students to earn certifications as part of their course curriculum and meeting their diploma needs. And the students take certification classes that lead to certifications in some of these STEM fields that directly result in them being employed right after high school, or at least ready to go into a post-secondary program with an even greater skill set.
Again, our guest today has been Jonathan Rothwell of Brookings. The new report is called Still Searching, Job Vacancies and STEM Skills. It's a comprehensive analysis of the nation's top 100 metro areas, in which Fresno ranked in the top 5 cities in the country when it comes to the difficulty of finding qualified workers for jobs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Gerald Haslam is something of a Renaissance man. A historian, novelist, essayist, and biographer, he is one of California's most respected writers and has devoted much of his career to telling stories about life in the Central Valley. His writing is much like the region he comes from, direct, unpretentious, and often filled with surprising depth and color. The Oildale native's newest book, Leon Patterson, A California Story, is co-authored with his wife Janice and tells the story of a young man from Taft who became one of the nation's top high school and collegiate athletes, only to have his life cut short by a terrible illness. In the process, Haslam gives us new insights into life in Kern County in the post-war years. Gerald Haslam joins us now on Valley Edition. Gerald, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I should add that Gerald joins us this morning, July 1st, on his 53rd wedding anniversary. Congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you even more for that.
Tell me about working on a book with your wife, both this new biography and your previous book on S.I. Hayakawa. You both shared a byline. What was that experience like?
Well, Jan has actually been important in all of my books. She does all the editing. She does the bibliography. She does the index. And she does some of the rewriting. So she should have had her name on the other 20-plus books, but I had to talk her into it. And she felt as though we didn't need two names on the covers. We work together very well. It's kind of interesting. I think it's pretty serendipitous how well you get along with people. We get along quite well.
That's it definitely sounds like a great team. Turning to this book now, on the surface, Leon Patterson might seem like an unlikely candidate for a biography. He had a tragically short life, but he's not a household name. How did you come across his story, and what drew you to share it with readers?
Well, I was a young high school athlete when Leon was. I was 3 years behind him, but I competed in some of the same track meets he did, and he was an absolute hero to those of us in the South Valley, at least. When he died, I was a high school journalist and still a high school athlete, and I found it almost unbelievable because this young man who seemed to be the apotheosis of athleticism was gone, and to most of us it seemed quite suddenly. And only much later did I realize that he had been diagnosed as terminally ill 3 years before his death, and had known he was going to die very young while he was accomplishing wonderful athletic feats. And the whole question of how does a young person, someone who's 17, 18, 19 years old, deal with that knowledge haunted me. And so I just felt as though I needed to. This is one of the books I had to write before I died, and so I've done it.
It's truly an amazing story. Much of Leon's story, though, has to do with his family and his upbringing, and it's a story that's not unique to him. Many in the South Valley and throughout California can share a similar story about how they came to the Golden State. Tell us about his family and what shaped him in his very early years.
Right. He was a migrant from Arkansas. His family had a small farm there that simply had gone belly up. It could not cope with the Depression economy. And so they had made their way west, as one of the brothers said to me, a day at a time. It took them almost something between 3 and 4 years to get to California. Desperate for work, The little kids had gone to work. Leon had started at the age of 6 working in the fields doing peace work. And they just hung on, basically, until the father finally found a job in the oil fields near Taft that had steady pay, that had retirement benefits, one thing and another. Unfortunately, the father was a drinker, and they never seemed to be able to get ahead economically, although by settling in the area around Taft, it allowed Leon for the first time to become a part of a settled society, and at that point he became a fairly good student and a wonderful athlete.
There's also a love interest in this story, and that's Dixie Kenny. Tell me about her and how she changed Leon's life.
I think it was absolutely serendipitous that Leon would encounter a girl like Dixie Kenny, who came from a settled family with real values that they pursued. She was an attractive, dark-haired girl, one of the beauties at Taft High School, also perhaps the top female athlete at Taft High School. And Leon began dating her when she was a freshman in high school. And they dated throughout her high school 4 years. Her family made him part of itself. So he had a group of people who offered him consistent social support at a time when poor kids could, in the Valley in particular, poor kids with Southern drawls could be discriminated against.
Yes, yes, indeed. There was also a coach that played a big role in Leon's life. Tell me about Tom O'Brien.
Tom O'Brien was another miracle in Leon's life. He was, aside from being perhaps the best technical coach for a shot putter, discus thrower, any place in the state for an interscholastic thrower, he was, again, a man of real values. He was a practicing Catholic who had a family of his own, and he welcomed Leon into his family, fed him. He spent nights there, and he made himself available to Leon for the kinds of talks you hope you can have with your parents, but that Leon seemed to have trouble having with his. So that, to a very real extent, Leon was adopted by Tom O'Brien and his family.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with author Gerald Haslam. His new book with his wife Janice is titled Leon Patterson, A California Story. It tells the story of a young man from Taft, California. Actually, I guess you could say from Derby Acres, California,
right,
if we really want to get specific here. And his rise as one of the top high school and collegiate athletes in America in the 1950s, only to have his life cut short at the age of just 22, leaving behind a young wife and a son. This is subtitled A California Story, and that's one of the things that really caught my attention. You really do more than just tell us Leon's personal story. You're also writing about Kern County and California in the 1950s, the years after the war, the years after the Great Migration, in the years following the Dust Bowl. This is as much about Kern County and Taft and places like that as it is about Leon, is it not?
It was intended to be. Everything happens in a context, and the context will shape how things happen. California was undergoing tremendous change at that time. The whole post-World War II crush was on. And you look, for example, at the San Joaquin Valley, just basically from Fresno south, and athletics spiked, a sudden, remarkable spike of world-class athletes emerged. Many of them were from families that had come from the South, the Mid-South, the Southwest, where there had been no opportunity for frivolities like sports or even frivolities like education in the view of some of the parents. And the Valley benefited tremendously from those kinds of people. And we think now about people like Rafer Johnson or Lamon King or Lon Spurrier, these wonderful world-class athletes who were very often the first members of their families to graduate from high school. So the Valley was changed, and they changed these young people who came as well. Our society is much richer, as far as I'm concerned, as a result of that migration.
You talked about the shock as a high school journalist learning of Leon's death. He was this superstar in Kern County back in the 1950s, went to USC, was probably going to be on the Olympic team, was an amazing shot put and discus athlete in track and field. And these are the days when track and field was a very big deal.
It was a big sport.
Tell us about a little more about that shock and what that was like and what he meant to Kern County in those days.
Well, I think Kern County was pretty parochial. It was pretty much an isolated place run by old families, and the value systems were old value systems that meant to perpetuate the power structure that had been there. When this migration occurred, it began to shake up the roots of those values. People had to look at a more multiracial kind of society. They had to look at a more multi-sectional kind of society. They had to understand that people who just happened to speak with a different twang were not inferior. And it enriched, in that sense, the perceptions of people in my generation. We were the first generation where you would see at the back of a team bus coming back from a track meet or a football game, the black kids and the white kids sitting together. That had never happened before. And that began to shape what was going to happen two decades hence. It was the first time when large numbers of Latinos got involved in intercollegiate and interscholastic sports, and that began to shape the society. I think it was churning. We didn't understand, those of us who were kids then, did not understand, I think, the unexpected consequences of our own social actions, but they have changed the place, I think, very much for the better.
We often hear stories about athletes overcoming adversity, and oftentimes they're somewhat cliche in nature. Leon Patterson dealt with a challenge that is absolutely the most severe anyone can think of, being diagnosed with a terminal disease, and yet he competed at the highest level. What does that say, or what does that say about him internally and his drive, and where do you see, how did that happen? Where did that come from that someone was able to do this?
You know, he did not have a strong spiritual background through his family, but I think that it was a spiritual gift, and that he was able to channel the frustration, the fear, the confusion of having that diagnosis. He was able to channel that into his competitive instinct, and he determined to do what he could do while he could do it as well as he possibly could, rather than simply giving up or simply asking for sympathy. And I think that spirit is something that was unique in him. I don't think everybody's got that any more than everybody's got the ability to be a world-class athlete. And Leon was it's sad to say it in this way, but he was sort of the right person for that kind of an experience, because I think he really grew through the experience and made the others around him grow, which is perhaps more important.
It's an amazing book, and it's available now. Again, it's called Leon Patterson, A California Story. Its author, Gerald Haslam, joins us on the phone today. His wife of 53 years, they're celebrating their anniversary today, in fact, is a co-author of the book. It tells the story of a young athlete from Taft High School in the 1950s who went on to become one of the nation's most gifted high school and collegiate athletes, only to die with a tragic illness at the age of 22, accomplishing these great feats, knowing he had this disease. The story also paints a picture of life in Kern County in the 1950s. The book is available on Devil Mountain Books. Gerald Haslam, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you, Joe.
That's all for today's program. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You can send us your comments, talk@kvpr.org via email, or tweet us @kvpr. We always like to know what you think, so let us know. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.